Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a really interesting and I think very useful show for you today. I have with me Dr. Jason Chi, who is a cardiac anesthesiologist at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto, California, and has asked himself a really interesting question, or he and his colleagues have, which is, how long after someone has COVID should we potentially do surgery and anesthesia for them? And interestingly, I haven't heard this being talked a huge amount about, but I think it's a question that we have all asked ourselves and will be asking ourselves more and more. And so I'm really excited to have Jason on the show to talk about some of the information they found and the recommendations they've put together, at least for themselves. And we want to be clear up front that we don't actually, this is not a societal guideline. We aren't telling people how to do this in their hospital. You should discuss it with your own hospital committees. But it'll be interesting, I think, for you to hear what Jason and his colleagues have done and how they got where they got. Does that sound right, Jason? Welcome to the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Jed. Happy to be here.
So let me ask you to just start off by telling the audience a little bit, what about you? Who are you? I said you're a cardiac anesthesiologist. If you want to add to that, please do. And then how, you know, what, why did you decide to do this and try to come up with these guidelines? What were you seeing? And what was your concerns that led you to this?
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks again for having me on, Jed. As Jed mentioned, I'm a cardiac anesthesiologist as well as a general anesthesiologist. I work currently at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Palo Alto, California. And I'm originally from Chicago, born and raised. I lived out there for many, many years, did all my training out in Chicago. Lifelong Bulls fan and a Bears fan, although they've had some tough years recently, but we'll get through them. And been out in California for a little bit now. Working at the VA and teaching residents as well as doing my own cases there. It's been fantastic. In terms of how we got started with this project and what we got interested, well, it actually got started with because we were beginning to encounter these patients who had recovered from COVID and they were coming in for surgery. And we realized that we didn't have an answer to the question of what is the appropriate amount of time a patient should recover from COVID before undergoing surgery, with the focus being on minimizing their risk of post-op complications.
Were you guys seeing significant numbers of complications, or was it just a concern that there would be? What was making you think we need to know this answer?
Right. No, good question. Yeah. Obviously, at our hospital, we have patients with, you know, pretty a high level of comorbidities and high level of acuity and chronic medical conditions. And that's a great question. We weren't actually seeing complications, thankfully, but there was a concern about complications related to, you know, ongoing physiologic changes from COVID. So, and patients who are coming in for surgery. Yeah. So basically, you know, as they say, necessity is the mother of invention. And we sort of asked ourselves, well, is there any guidance on this? Is there any literature out there on this? And there really wasn't. And as you mentioned, there's not a whole lot of talk about it, which is a little bit surprising. So that's what inspired us to go on our little project and come up with some recommendations and put together the existing knowledge. Yeah,
that's great. And I'm glad you did. You know, I myself in the ICU have seen a couple of people at least already who had previous COVID, totally recovered, or, you know, felt they were totally recovered, maybe had some, just, you know, if you really pushed. You could find maybe a couple little mm-hmm. symptoms, but basically had recovered, had surgery, and did remarkably poorly. You know, otherwise healthy people who shouldn't have either been in the ICU or should have had a very straight, easy course in the ICU, who struggled to come off oxygen, for example, post-op. So wow. I do think wow. that this is an important issue, and that we will start seeing complications.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, this 12, 13 million people, you know, as of today, and, you know, that turns out to be about one in every 28 Americans has had COVID, unfortunately. And yeah, unfortunately, it's we're still in the middle of this pandemic. And yes, it's a question that we're not only going to be encountering, but that folks are encountering probably right this minute in operating rooms around the country, if not around the world. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, as you said, there wasn't a lot out there. So how did you guys go about putting together recommendations for yourself?
Yeah. So what we did was, you know, we started with just a simple literature search. I mean, we looked at the ASA, we looked at the American College of Surgeons, we looked at the CDC, we looked at UpToDate, all the sort of usual places, and really only found very sort of generic guidance regarding this specific topic. And so what we did was I recruited two of my colleagues whom I'd like to thank and recognize, Carlos Brun and Jody Lang. The three of us, we did a literature search, and we collected information on three aspects, sort of a three-pronged approach. One was emerging knowledge about COVID and its pathophysiology and the physiologic changes that it causes in the body. As we know, COVID can affect virtually all major organ systems, and it seems like not a week goes by that we learn something new about COVID and its effect on the human body. It's really really a truly evolving type of situation. Second is we used existing knowledge of other disease processes and their relationship with perioperative risk. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But obviously, there's quite a body of literature that relates to existing comorbidities, as well as acute infections, respiratory infections, and their relationship with perioperative risk. And the third was that we had some literature from previous pandemics, namely the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic. And so we were able to use some of the information from that, the literature from that, and the recovery course of that to inform our literature search as well.
Great. So you know, essentially you looked at things that were as similar as possible to, you know, what you were interested in. So what did you find? What did you guys come up with?
Yeah. So the intent behind our project here was that we were going to do the literature search, gather the science together, and that we wanted to create a clinical decision tool that would aid surgeons and anesthesiologists in making a decision about the question of how long should a patient who has recovered from COVID wait before having surgery and anesthesia with the goal of minimizing postoperative complications. I do want to emphasize that this is a question that's distinct from the question of retesting or the question of isolation, because most, if not all, hospitals already have protocols in place, pretty detailed protocols regarding retesting of patients who have previously tested positive. And then also protocols in terms of when can we release patients from isolation, when can we feel confident that they're not infectious anymore. But this is a different question. So this is a question about how do we minimize postoperative complications in these patients who have COVID. And so we did this literature search, and we came up with sort of a simple clinical decision tool in the form of a table that we felt would be very useful for surgeons and anesthesiologists.
And we can include that if you want. I don't know if you guys may want to wait until you kind of go through whatever publication processes, but we may be able to at some point put that in the show notes. But also, you know, Jason, if you can kind of walk us through it, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the timing, we call the table the timing of intermediate risk and high risk surgery after COVID-19 diagnosis. The reason that we specifically looked at intermediate risk and high risk is that for low risk surgery, which we will classify in our for the purposes of our paper here, low risk surgery is considered office-based surgery or very superficial cosmetic or surgery which does not require anything beyond local anesthesia. So those things I think we were not really considering for the purposes of our literature search. But in terms of intermediate risk and high risk surgery, which the vast majority of us as anesthesiologists will be involved in, we came up with this table, basically both a symptom-driven and a time-driven approach. So sort of a hybrid approach to how to approach these patients after they've had recovery from COVID. So the first category is patients were either asymptomatic during their COVID-19 infection, or they had only mild transient symptoms, meaning fever, headache. So just like as the descriptor says, mild and transient. And we came up with a suggested minimum wait time for 4 weeks from the time of diagnosis until the actual time of surgery. And I'll go into a little bit later about why we chose time from diagnosis versus time from symptom onset or time from symptom offset. And I can go into that in a little bit more detail later. The second category is patients who are symptomatic during their COVID infection. So patients particularly who had cough or shortness of breath, chest pain, fatigue, significant symptoms, perhaps longer lasting as well. We came up with a suggested minimum wait time of 6 weeks from the time of diagnosis to the time that they undergo surgery. The next category that we had was patients who are diabetic, hospitalized, or are immunocompromised. And obviously these three categories represent patients who obviously have more serious physiologic changes and who are more predisposed to serious disease, to serious COVID disease. And for them, for this category of patients, we had 8 to 10 weeks as the minimum wait time from diagnosis. And then finally, in the more severe category is the patients who were admitted to an ICU. Obviously, these patients were quite ill. We didn't make any distinction between whether they had been intubated or not. We didn't feel that the literature was able to give us that detail, a level of granularity. But anyone who was admitted to the ICU, 12 weeks, we felt was a pretty reasonable suggestion for wait times after their operation. And I'd be happy to kind of walk through each of those categories and how we came up with those timelines as well.
Yeah, maybe give some, examples of also like what you, I think you said it kind of for asymptomatic or mild transient, you're talking about like a headache, et cetera.
Right.
You mentioned the cough, the shortness of breath. And then for a diabetic, you're putting someone in that category as a diabetic, regardless of their control or, they could be well controlled as long as they have the diagnosis of diabetes.
Yeah. That's a tough question. I mean, is a patient who has really good control of, their diabetes, their A1C is under good control. Are they at less risk for severe COVID or are they at less risk for post-op complications after surgery? It's really tough to say. I mean, the literature really does not have anything out there that I'm aware of that breaks that question down to that level of detail. But we do know that patients with diabetes have a higher risk of having severe COVID. We do know that they have a higher risk of being hospitalized and of being admitted to the ICU. I think there's pretty robust data out there on this during this current pandemic. So we felt that generally speaking, diabetes was a higher risk category. In addition to the fact that we already know that, and this is where the pre-existing knowledge comes in as well, is that we know that patients with diabetes represent a mild immunocompromised state. Putting all those factors together, we felt that it was appropriate to put him in a higher risk category. Yep.
Sounds good. And do you want to just say a word about how you said you wanted to talk about or come back to how you thought about time from diagnosis versus time from something else?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a question that we encountered kind of early in our feedback when we were, showing this paper to some of our colleagues in our department. Was, why did you choose time from diagnosis? Why not time from symptom onset? Or why not time from symptom offset? And there's two reasons for that. One is that the time of diagnosis is a known entity, right? I mean, there's a definite date. There's a time and date stamp, if you will, on that. Whereas time of symptom onset can be pretty vague. And that's based on the patient's recollection, right? And so that can be sort of all over the place. And that's not very, that can be pretty ambiguous at times. Same thing with symptom offset as well. Again, if you were to ask the patient about it, it would be entirely subjective. The patient could say, well, I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was this day, it was that day. So we felt that the time of diagnosis was sort of a definite landmark, sort of a stick in the ground, as if you will, for us to start with. The other thing is that the other reason we chose that was because the only study which looked at this exact question, timing of surgery after COVID recovery and post-op complications, they used as their for their timelines time of diagnosis as well. So in that study, they had used that. So we felt that it was appropriate to sort of go along with that and then use that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. All right. So do you want to walk through the table?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in the first category, we, like I mentioned, we had asymptomatic or mild transient symptoms. We chose 4 weeks as the minimum length of time. And it appears to have support from both the emerging literature as well as pre-existing literature regarding respiratory infections after surgery. We know that one of the main organ systems that's affected by COVID is obviously the respiratory system. I think, you know, that's pretty well established. We know from previous literature that airway hyperreactivity can persist from 2 to 4 weeks after a respiratory infection. We know that. We've also found that a respiratory infection within the month preceding surgery is independently associated with postoperative pulmonary complications. And this is, you know, this is data from the pre-COVID era. So again, do we have great data from the COVID era? We don't, but that doesn't, I don't feel that that absolves us from the responsibility of at least looking through the literature and trying to make analogies from, you know, from our existing knowledge and trying to transfer that to our current pandemic. The 4 weeks was also chosen because, like I had mentioned a little bit earlier, there is one study out there that examined this question. It's called the COVID Surge Collaborative. It's out of England, and they looked at 122 patients who underwent cancer surgery after a prior COVID-19 diagnosis. And their focus was on postoperative pulmonary complications, which they defined as pneumonia, ARDS, and or unexpected ventilation within 30 days after their surgery. And it's very interesting. They found an odds ratio of 3.8 for pulmonary complications if the patient had had a previous COVID infection. But strangely enough, in their data, 4 weeks seemed to be the inflection point. So after 4 weeks, the risk of pulmonary complications and mortality were actually 0%, whereas prior to 4 weeks, they had a significantly increased risk of pulmonary complications. So a couple of notes of caution about this study. It's a very small study, 122 patients. Unfortunately, the authors were not able to describe the severity of illness in the patient cohort and any relationship between patient illness and wait time of surgery and then postoperative pulmonary complications. So they, I don't think the sample size of 122 allowed them to run those kind of analyses, which is, you know, unfortunate, but that's the, you know, that's the nature of the study. The other thing of note in this study is that patients with a pre-existing respiratory illness had a 2.3 odds ratio of pulmonary complications. So, so again, to break it down, it seems like from this limited study of 122 patients who underwent cancer surgery after a COVID diagnosis, it seems that having surgery within 4 weeks of the diagnosis was associated with a much higher risk of pulmonary post-op pulmonary complications.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving on to the symptomatic. So patients who are symptomatic with cough, shortness of breath, again, we felt that since we had arrived at the time frame of 4 weeks for the asymptomatic and the mild transient symptom patients, we felt that 6 weeks was a very reasonable wait time for symptomatic patients who have, you know, recovered from their cough and their shortness of breath, but now are coming from surgery. Again, not a whole lot of data regarding this specific question. But again, we were sort of extrapolating from the existing knowledge that I had just discussed. And then we were also extrapolating from some of the other more severe categories as well. So the diabetics, hospitalized, which I'll get into as well. In terms of the diabetic, hospitalized, immunocompromised patients, we had recommended 8 to 10 weeks for these patients from the time of their diagnosis to the time they have surgery. And like we mentioned before, patients with diabetes, they're a high-risk category as it relates to COVID disease. They're more likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to have severe COVID, more likely to be admitted to the ICU. We know that hyperglycemia is a form of a chronic inflammatory state, and it induces immune dysfunction. So it's a form of immunocompromise. And one of the fascinating things is that the angiotensin converting enzyme type 2 receptor, which is the receptor for SARS-CoV-2, it's actually expressed widely throughout the body, including on pancreatic cells. It's amazing. And they found back in 2004, in the 2004 SARS outbreak, they found that the coronavirus enters the pancreas and actually causes acute diabetes. We don't know if that's the case with our current pandemic with SARS-CoV-2. But again, just all kinds of surprises with this coronavirus. So
yeah.
And so we felt that for patients who have diabetes, hospitalized, immunocompromised, we felt that 8 to 10 weeks was a very reasonable time frame for these people. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And then your final group is the group that's been admitted to the ICU, and as you said, whether or not they've been intubated, just being admitted to an ICU.
Correct. Yeah, and the data from the ICU, actually a lot of it came from the 2009 influenza A H1N1 pandemic at that time, and there was a study, I believe it was from Taiwan, in which they looked at patients who had survived, been in the ICU, but had survived, and they did pulmonary function tests serially on these patients during their recovery period, and they found that parameters of pulmonary function, such as total lung capacity, forced vital capacity, FEV1, DLCO, 6-minute walk, these parameters continued to improve up to 3 months after patients were discharged from the hospital. And I think it's pretty well established in the ICU literature that patients can have prolonged myopathy, prolonged muscle weakness after an extended ICU admission as well. So these patients are clearly at much higher risk of complications within any short time period after their recovery. So we felt 3 months or perhaps even more, depending on the patient's state, would be appropriate. Yeah, yeah, very much so.
Let me just ask quickly, do we know if, and there probably is no way to know, but do you think there's any indication of whether patients who are, you know, let's say 12 weeks out from an ICU admission for COVID, how that relates to or compares to the complication rate for patients who were in an ICU for something other than COVID? Like, is there something, does COVID make it worse?
Yeah, no, I'm not aware of any studies specifically addressing that question. Yeah, no, and that's a very interesting question too. I would imagine that there would be some influence based on organ system, right? Because again, COVID can affect all major organ systems. So, you know, are we talking about an ICU admission for, you know, respiratory failure? Are we talking about myocarditis and heart failure?
Right. You know,
are we talking about kidney failure and dialysis? I think those categories can quickly get very, right, very varied depending right on the patient's state. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting. I think we just must not know the answer, but someone admitted, you know, someone who spent time in ICU for ARDS, not from COVID, versus somebody who, you know, had ARDS from COVID. Is there a difference in terms of long lasting respiratory complications?
There's one thing I wanted to mention. You know, one is that we are seeing that a lot of patients are, there's a high incidence of residual symptoms in patients who have recovered from COVID. And, you know, that's pretty concerning because let's say a patient comes to you in the pre-op clinic and, you know, they want to have a hernia repair or whatnot, but 4 weeks out, 6 weeks out, 8 weeks out, whatever have you, and the patients say they're still fatigued, They're still getting short of breath with activity. Obviously, their functional capacities much decreased due to these symptoms. You know, how do we handle these patients? And that was another question that we had been encountering from our colleagues as well. And this is a really uncharted territory, I think. I feel like there's very little literature, if any literature, on it. And the literature is showing that there's a high percentage of patients who have residual symptoms. So one study from Italy, which was published in JAMA over the summer, found that at a median follow-up of 60 days, that's a long time, right? 60 days, 2 months, only 12% of the patients said they were completely symptom-free. 12%. Wow. That's, yeah. And 43% of them reported dyspnea at 60 days, right? And so that's really significant. And then a study from the U.S., which was published in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, found that 29%, so almost a third, reported shortness of breath at 2 to 3 weeks after the diagnosis. And these are actually patients who are outpatients. So these are patients who were never admitted to a hospital, and they're still reporting shortness of breath 2 to 3 weeks after their diagnosis. And so this is a problematic area in terms of patients, you know, who are have residual symptoms and are going to come in for consideration for surgery. The question that we were, you know, kind of throwing around amongst ourselves was, well, you know, obviously these patients need a higher level of workup, a more extensive and intensive workup. But, you know, is that really going to yield us anything? You know, are we going to do PFTs and, you know, what is the value of that? Or are we going to do an echo? Or, you know, are we going to do something more, a chest CT? And these are questions that are really unanswered. And I feel at this point have to handle on sort of a case by case basis.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think really, you know, having a broader guideline or policy or a way to feel like you're at least, you know, practicing some best practices is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, I do want to emphasize that, you know, this is sort of the product of our research, of a literature search. You know, it's not meant to be, these timelines are not meant to be definitive. They're not meant to be guidelines. I think they're a good starting point to make an informed decision about when it's appropriate to bring a patient to surgery with an eye to reducing their post-op pulmonary complications. Again, we've sort of put together the emerging knowledge, the existing knowledge, and as well as clinical judgment to shed some light on this question. Whereas currently we felt that we were sort of operating in the dark and just making ad hoc decisions, which, you know, obviously is not, not really optimal.
Right. You know? No, absolutely. Yeah. Jason, anything else you think we should cover for folks here?
Yeah, there was one thing that I wanted to mention as well. And so, you know, being a cardiac anesthesiologist, I have an interest in the cardiac effects of COVID, which has also been very interesting. There was a study from Germany over the summer. They did a cardiac MRI study in 100 patients, which is really a tremendous undertaking. You know, considering the cardiac MRI is a pretty time-intensive, investigation. So anyway, 100 adult patients at a median of 71 days after diagnosis. So this is 10 weeks, right? Adult patients. They found evidence of ongoing myocardial inflammation in 60% of the patients. And what's really interesting about this is that the presence or absence of the inflammation was actually not correlated with the severity of their COVID disease when they had COVID. And so, it's very interesting stuff. Troponin was detectable at the time of their MRI in 71% of patients, so almost 3/4.
Wow.
So it really goes to show you that there are some long-term effects of COVID that probably are just going unrecognized within the general population. And these patients are showing up for surgery and, you know, and what is the effect of ongoing myocarditis or ongoing myocardial inflammation on a patient's postoperative course or perioperative course? It's really hard to say. But I think it's important that we have the recognition that this is possibly out, you know, this is out there. What's very, very interesting about this study is that they also did echoes on all of the patients as well. And the patients had the patients who had evidence of ongoing myocardial inflammation had very, very slightly decreased EFs. So according to their data, those patients had an EF of 57 plus minus a standard deviation of 6, whereas in the healthy controls had an EF of 60 plus minus 5. So you can see that the standard deviations of those two values are overlapping. So the upshot of what I'm taking away from this is that a lot of patients who come for preoperative evaluation and get an echo could have, conceivably, they could have a normal EF, and yet they could have ongoing myocarditis, ongoing myocardial inflammation that's not being picked up or recognized by a transthoracic echo. And the question becomes, well, what is the significance of this? Again, you know, what can be done about this? It's really tough to say. I don't think I have a good answer for the audience about that. Really don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we'll just have to keep our eyes out for more as this gets, as we get further in and more people go through, and we'll see what's seen and what studies are done, right?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that's very exciting is that there is one study that's being, that's ongoing right now. And it's called the COVID. It's from the same group that did the COVID surge collaborative. That had the 122 patients that I'd mentioned, where they found the 4 weeks was sort of the inflection point. And they called it the COVID surge global week study. And it's very interesting. They basically, for lack of a better term, they sort of they made a website, and they invited pretty much any hospital or any investigator from any hospital around the world to join them in this study and basically input data, obviously anonymized patient data, and patients who had recovered from COVID and then at various time periods after their recovery undergone surgery. And so they basically crowdsourced the study, collected data, I believe, in October and into the beginning of November. As of November 21, I followed them on Twitter. They had tweeted that they had recruited 100,000 patients from 110 countries. And so this is going to be very exciting because this is actually the exact question they're looking at, the timing of recovery from surgery. Recovery from COVID, and then the timing of surgery, and then post-op complications. So hopefully with this very robust data set, we're going to get a lot of answers. And for the listeners who are out there, I think this is going to be pretty exciting stuff. So again, the COVID surge global week study. And I think that's going to hopefully shed a lot of light on this important question and give us sort of a way forward on this.
Yeah, that's great. Will be really helpful to see. Anything else on the topic? You've put a lot of great work and thought into it.
Yeah, no. I think that, I sort of covered the major portions of it. Again, I do want to recognize my collaborators, Carlos Brun, Jody Lang, and then also Kyle Harrison and Clarity Kaufman at the VA in Palo Alto, who also took a look at our manuscript and gave us some feedback. Also want to thank our department chair, Ed Mariano. He's been very supportive of us and is obviously very, very helpful in terms of giving us editorial feedback and content feedback as well. So, I think that kind of wraps it up. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. This has been great. Let's go to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What's something that you would recommend to the audience? Something you've been doing during COVID that has kept you busy, a movie, TV show, whatever you think.
Sure. Now, this is... Actually, I may have spent more time thinking about this than I did about the paper. So one thing is actually one thing that caught my eye recently was it's a movie that's coming out soon, I believe. I don't know if it's going to be released online or what's have theatrical release. It's a movie called Minari, M-I-N-A-R-I, and Minari is a it's a plant, which is, I believe, native to Korea. And it's a type of parsley, I believe. And it's the name of the movie. And it stars Steven Yeun, who is of Walking Dead fame. He was Glenn in Walking Dead. And he's a Korean-American actor. And it's very interesting story about a Korean family that immigrates to Arkansas and wants to begin a new life there. And it's when I saw the trailer for it, it really sort of hit home because, you know, I, being the child of immigrants, also from Korea, there are a lot of scenes in that movie that, in the trailer at least, that kind of hit home for me. And Steven Yeun, obviously a great actor, and just looked like a really great cast, really interesting movie. And just a movie about, you know, the American dream, right? Coming to America to live a better life and how that plays out. I thought that was just looked really interesting. So I'm hoping to see it soon. And so I'm looking forward to that. The other recommendation, not quite so random perhaps, but something that's has a special place in for me is if for those of you who are considering any types of charitable donations would be for Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF for short, which is a French name. But I have a connection with them because after I finished my fellowship, I worked for Doctors Without Borders for 3 months as a volunteer anesthesiologist overseas. And really a life-changing experience, you know, a positive life-changing experience, pretty challenging experience, I would say. But I can assure you, I can assure the listeners that donations to MSF and Doctors Without Borders are being spent well. They're being spent to help the lives of people who are, you know, caught in very unfortunate circumstances, which are mostly beyond their control. And as someone who has volunteered for them, I feel that, yeah, I mean, they're doing great work. So that's my little plug for them. So,
great. Well, yeah. Great recommendation. We'll put links in the show notes. And I would say that I am going to recommend a little kid's show called Daniel Tiger. So it's something I would recommend people watch. Have you guys used this? But I think for
I have seen it.
But I, you know, for our like 2.5-3 year old type age, I think it starts to, if you're going to let them watch a little bit of something, it starts to teach them good ways to handle their anger and frustration. And it's fun. They like it. So it's something I would check out if you got little kids.
I recommend that as well. Yeah. Yeah. My daughter had the Daniel Tiger phase as well. So
nice. Yeah. We've made good use of it over time. Well,
fantastic.
Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show and for doing the work that you've done.
Thank you for having me, Jed. It was a pleasure. Yeah.
All right. That was great. I hope everybody found that useful. I know I definitely did. Please let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Walpaw, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. You can join the Facebook group as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you would like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make individual donations anytime you like by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking up Jay Walpaw on Venmo. Huge thanks to those who have already become patrons and made donations. We really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. Big thanks, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, our tech lead, to April Liu, our social media manager, and to Dr. Kimmy Akash Cooley for her ongoing help. Original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Jason Chi, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.